Today on Political Rewind, did the Thursday Democratic presidential debate change the dynamics of who's winning and who's lagging behind? How will voters react to the dramatically different Democratic proposals on health care? And who looked most ready to take on President Trump? Turn off your record players, kids. Political Rewind starts now.
Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. So glad to have you with us today. We do have a lot to talk about in terms of the presidential debate, but we also want to talk about some important issues right here in the state of Georgia. We'll do that with Jim Galloway. Of course, he's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the newspaper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. You got a column for Sunday already? We usually
It's on ballot building being done by Republicans and Democrats.
Okay, good. So you can read that online at AJC.com or wait for Sunday morning when you get your newspaper in your driveway. Alan Abramowitz is with us, a professor, longtime professor of political science at Emory University. How long have you been at Emory now, Alan?
Longer than I care to remember. No, I've been there since 1987.
Okay.
However many years that is.
Alan, we usually really love having you come on. You've got, when you're published, a new book, and I'm really glad to have you here to talk about the debate, among other things that we're going to discuss today. Thank you for being here. Amy Steigerwalt, professor of political science at Georgia State University, a regular on our panel, is here. Thank you for being here, Amy.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
We talk about your books, too. You've written on the issues of women in politics, the electability of women in politics, among any number of other subjects. Sam?
Yes.
Great. And we have a first-time panelist on the show, who I'm really thrilled is with us, Mo Ivory. Mo Ivory is an attorney. She has been a media personality. If you've been a listener of V103, you would know Mo Ivory's name. And it's just really a delight to have you here, Mo. You also do some political consulting as well with Fair Action now, Georgia, right?
Right, Fair Fight Action.
Yep. Fair Fight Action. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right, let's get right to work on talking about this debate. So to set the stage a little bit, Jim, this, of course, is the first time that we've had a single night of debating. The first two debates were actually four debates. There were so many candidates on the stage, they couldn't get everybody on one stage. So finally we saw the front runners, the presumed front runners by all the polling, appear on the same stage, and the candidates who are lagging behind as well. Just give me your first take, if you don't mind. Let's start with the front runners. You've got Biden, Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. Did you see anything last night that caused you to think that Biden in front, Elizabeth Warren a little ahead of Bernie Sanders, depending on the day and the poll, and those two kind of reversing roles every now and then. Did you see anything that changed the dynamic last night?
No, I think I did. The one thing that I did see, and it wasn't confined to those three candidates, but I saw the issues rise up. And the division on those issues, mm-hmm. in particular on health care. You had Joe Biden starting it off. Then you had Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders chiming in. But then you also had two other centrists, if you will, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, kind of come down on Joe Biden's side. So I thought that was a really interesting enunciation of a debate in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think in a few minutes we should talk a little bit about that long, deep in the weeds conversation about health care, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Amy, I think in a general conclusion it might be fair to reach would be that it was an issue-oriented debate. I would think if you're a Democrat just observing out there on television, you'd come away saying, gee, we've got candidates who really understand the issues that matter to them they may not be the issues that the American voter is going to go for next November, but these are a bunch of smart people who really care about the issues. Is that fair characterization?
I think that is very true. And I think one of the things that we really noticed from this debate from the last one is that let the candidates have longer answers and longer time to speak, which allowed them to give more nuanced policy discussion. And it was very clear that the candidates wanted to discuss policy. They wanted to, at times, get into the weeds and be able to make those. And so I think that that was really robust because it really was a very issue-centered debate on that level. And I think that was really helpful for, you know, moving us forward in the Democratic primary.
So the same question that I asked Jim, because I'll ask everyone, anything that changed the dynamic of who's leading in this race, is that who's going to be leading when the polling shows what the impact of the debate was?
Probably not. My guess is what we're going to continue to see is it's that jockeying between those top three. The trend line so far has been Biden slowly ticking down and particularly Elizabeth Warren slowly ticking up. She's made probably the most jump since really all of the debates have started. And there wasn't a lot that came out of last night that I think is going to change that. But I think that's probably, again, our top three.
Ellen, so what about that question first? Much of a change?
I don't think we're going to see a big change. I wouldn't be surprised to see Elizabeth Warren continue to gain ground relative to Bernie Sanders. To me, Bernie Sanders came across as rather strident. His issue positions are hardly distinguishable from Elizabeth Warren's, but stylistically, you know, I think there's a big difference between the two of them, and that helps to explain why she's been gaining ground on him, and I think that happened last night. He sounded hoarse to me also. Yeah. I'm not sure what was going on there.
Apparently he is hoarse, right?
And that understandably.
That made his kind of, he does have a, you know, I know that the people who love him. Yeah,
and they still will.
But he does have a somewhat abrasive personality on the campaign trail. Although the hoarseness of his voice didn't help that last night
So I think that came through. And so we may see some movement along those lines. I thought Biden did pretty well, actually, in defending himself and getting Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg to come in and kind of join with him in attacking the Sanders-Warren Medicare for All plan. I thought was helpful to him, actually. There may be some movement among the also-rans. So Beto O'Rourke, I thought, had a pretty good night. I wouldn't be surprised to see him move up a few points. But I don't think there's going to be any shift between the top three and the rest. I mean, I think we'll continue to see that divide.
You know, Mo, there were two different divides, it seems to me, on that stage last night. The front runners and
everybody
the also-rans, everybody else, and the liberals and the moderates.
Yeah.
The liberals, of course, as Alan just said, represented most particularly by Warren and Sanders. The thing that was of great interest to me last night was that nobody touched Elizabeth Warren. I mean, here she is, as Amy just said, moving up in the polls. She seems to be gaining popularity, big rallies for her out there across the states that she's been campaigning in. And she went untouched the whole evening. What's going on there?
Yeah, you know, she has such an even tone, and I think sometimes she gets lost in the shuffle because of that. She also did not get as many questions as everybody else. Mm-hmm. She also did not interject in the way others interjected themselves into the conversation. So I think it was partly her fault and partly the fault of the ABC panel that were asking the questions, because she just didn't seem to get as many as even Yang got. So that was a little bit puzzling to me. But I also think that she's going to have to step it up, and she's going to have to begin to be a little bit more responsive, and it's not her style to go after people. I do love that about her. So I think that it's the way that she presents, but she's going to have to interject more, and the way Biden did last night, in a way he hadn't done in the first and second debates, which is he normally retracts when he sees that the clock is over and his time is up, but he didn't do that this time. He was very strong. He was clearly presidential, I felt. And I think that she's going to have to sort of take that tone on in order for her numbers to continue to rise.
I think I would just disagree just ever so slightly with Mo here, that I think one reason that she didn't get a whole lot of the time is that there was a definite reluctance among the other candidates to go after her.
Well, that's
to
my
engage
point.
Her. And I think, you know, I was watching her last night, and I was remembering when Barack Obama always brought in Bill Clinton as the explainer in chief. and that's become her great, that's really become a great talent that she's showing right now, that she can get into those weeds very, very deep, but she always brings it back to kind of the kitchen table. And I think that talent is, it kind of makes her hard to deal with on an attack.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I think there's a certain amount of humanity with Elizabeth Warren that people don't want to attack. You know, the teacher in her, the mother in her. I just, she's never been sort of open that door because she doesn't do it herself. And so I think there's a little bit of reluctance for all of them to seem that like, oh, now it's time to go after Elizabeth. The way they did it in the second debate, it was like, okay, it's time to go after Joe Biden. And it was just a collective, you know, it didn't work, right? So I think that they're thinking about that when they think about Elizabeth Warren.
I thought it was interesting that the criticism of Medicare for All that we heard coming from Biden, but also from Klobuchar, from Buttigieg, even from Cory Booker somewhat, was focused mainly on Bernie.
Exactly.
Focused mainly on him. And that's partly, I think, because of the way he presents it. You know, I wrote the damn bill, which gives everyone a chance to say, you know, what's wrong with the damn bill, or as Amy Klobuchar very cleverly said, I read the damn bill.
Yeah, you may have written it, but I read it.
So he's gotten most of the flack, even though, you know, she's right there with him.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And she has not really separated herself from him the way Kamala Harris has. So Kamala Harris kind of started out on that team. Now she's kind of moved away and said, well, Medicare for All, but we're going to keep, you can have keep your private health insurance if you want to. So she's really moving into the Medicare for All who want it.
You know, Amy, there was some of the commentary this morning was pointed out that Elizabeth Warren disappeared for quite a length of time, especially during the healthcare portion of the debate. And there was criticism, where was she during all that? Mm-hmm. If you're moving up in the polls, if you're seeing steady growth, I'm not so sure that you have to rely on the strength of performance in this one debate. If you're confident that you're continuing to move, it actually may be kind of smart to back up a little and let other people battle it out, as the liberals and moderates did over health care last night.
I'll admit that I had a bit of that thought, and also simply the thought that this is, again, the first time that they've all been on the stage together. So we haven't seen, especially Warren, Sanders, Biden all together, as well as those that are polling down ballot. And so I think part of what was also going on is that in many ways people see that, number one, Biden is the one that they've got to really run against. And Bernie has this very core, very strong set of supporters that I think, again, it's trying to make inroads in that or trying to suggest. And there might be a way in which for Elizabeth Warren it was, you know what, I'm going to let everybody else sort of have their say. I'm just going to stand right here. I'm going to give, you know, my answers. But Medicare for All, Bernie, go for it.
All right, so let's talk about that for a minute, Jim. Again, one debate, we clearly saw the divide in the Democratic Party over just how far to go with health care. Mm-hmm. You have the Biden faction of the party. Amy Klobuchar is in that camp. I think Buttigieg is in that camp. Let's take what we've got. Obamacare was hard to get through the Congress in the first place. Mm-hmm. Let's build upon it and make it better. And then, of course, the liberals, the Warren and Sanders faction, saying, scrap it, let's have a single-payer system. How are we going to, voters out there, if they're really starting to pay attention now, which argument do we think is going to be an argument you want to stick with when you have to run a general election campaign?
Well, you know, I think this is... One thing that Biden has not done yet is, and it's hard to during a primary because you don't want to discourage your voters, but he has not reminded people exactly how hard it was for Barack Obama to pass anything, and what a tribal reaction he provoked when he became president, and that reaction. Look, even if Democrats win in November 2020, and Ellen, you tell me if I'm wrong here, I don't think the world changes. I don't think, you know, we are still going to be working with a very, very thin margin on in the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
And that means you better be very realistic about what you're promising.
Well, we both know, Jim, that this is an area of expertise for Abramowitz. You, when it comes to looking at, you know, at divisiveness in the party, at factionalism, that's really a sweet spot for you. How do you read this moderate versus liberal
split? Well, when it
comes
to, you know, proposal as drastic as Medicare for All, as proposed by Bernie Sanders, for example, and Elizabeth Warren, whatever you think of the merits of it, it's not going to happen. That's not going to pass Congress. In any conceivable result that we can think of, even if Democrats hold on to the House, maybe pick up a few seats in the House, pick up a few seats, gain control of the Senate. But if they do that, and which is far from certain, it would be by a very narrow margin, 51-49, maybe 50-50 with the vice president casting the tie vote. There are a number of Democrats in the Senate who certainly would never support that proposal.
So,
and even in the House, they won't get, I don't think they can get muster 218 votes in the House.
So, Mo, if that's the case, and I think a lot of people agree with Helen on that, what think about Georgia voters. What are Democrats, as they pursue the liberal wing of the candidacies, as they pursue this single-payer, Medicare for All, whatever they want to call it, what do you think they're doing to Democratic voters in a state like Georgia?
Confusing them. I think it would just really. Jim, I think you made a really good point. When you have a success, you know, however people understand it in whatever capacity they understand Obamacare, it was branded as a universal plan for everyone. If Biden could just use that branding to his advantage and then say, but I'm going to fix the things that people didn't like, I think voters can understand that. I don't think any voters think we're about to overhaul the healthcare system again. And so I think it's a mistake to keep, it was very confusing for people. I last night was in D.C. when I was watching the debate, and I was with a group of folks that were in town for a big conference, and there were a lot of gasps and oh, that's gonna make our voters go away. Oh, that's gonna deter people. They don't understand what it means that you automatically have to go into this system. So I really think it's a mistake to do that. I think we should stick with sort of, that's why there's marketing and there's an attachment to a name that people can understand. And I think that Biden did a good job last night by saying, we have Obamacare. Let's fix it and expand it. And I thought that was
several
good.
Of the candidates. Mm-hmm.
So, Amy, policy is a real area of strength for you. Mm-hmm. So basically, kind of two questions around all that, picking up on what we've been discussing. One of them is, I, as a viewer, and I think of myself as someone who pays pretty close attention to politics. Mm-hmm. I was lost in that entire section of the debate about single payer, about do you have to opt in? Do you not have to opt in? Mm-hmm. How are you? I thought that Kamala Harris in some ways brought Democrats to the kind of message Mo is talking about when she said, all of us on this stage believe in universal health care. However we want to get there, we believe it's your right to be covered. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump spent the first year of his presidency trying to dismantle it. That's the choice you have. That's the kind of statement that people might be able to rally around. You get into the weeds on some of this
stuff.
But
it's not a statement you can make until you're down to one, two, or three candidates.
Well, and I think that's where the difficulty is talking about the framing and how it is that they want to present this on sort of a policy side, right? Because, again, even though this technically was the longer debate answer version, they still got at most 60 seconds. And a lot of this is incredibly complex. It's about trying to get to also the same end goal. I mean, I think that is really very true. Everybody is about how do we expand access? How do we do that? It's certainly not a going back and forth. And so it's getting lost in that framing, which is what they are allowing them to do, particularly the Republicans right now, by having sort of the fight they're having, is they're allowing Republicans to be able to frame it as Democrats want to take away something.
Right.
And no one is really doing a good job in saying, well, wait, this is about, it's not about insurance, it's about access, and we don't want to take it away. And there was a little attempt at that, but not very well last
night. Let's start playing some sound from the debate. Here's Kamala Harris making the point that I just talked about.
Everybody on this stage, I do believe, is well-intentioned and wants that all Americans have coverage and recognizes that right now 30 million Americans don't have coverage. But at least five people have talked, some repeatedly on this subject, and not once have we talked about Donald Trump. So let's talk about the fact that Donald Trump came into office and spent almost the entire first year of his term trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. We all fought against it, and then the late, great John McCain, at that moment at about 2 o'clock in the morning, killed his attempt to take health care from millions of people in this country.
All right, so Jim, your point is that as long as you've got a larger Democratic field, everybody's going to have their own health care plan. You can't expect them all to get on the same page.
They all want to be able to differentiate.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the other divide on the stage, Alan, and that was the front runners and those who are trying to gain oxygen.
Yeah.
And first question about that is, it's, you know, people keep saying, well, it's still early. But if you're out there looking to raise money for your campaign that you'll be able to keep moving forward, it's not too early at all, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, it's getting pretty late. And I think we're going to see over the next month or two, maybe before the next debates, some more dropouts, some more candidates drop out, largely because they're not going to be able to raise the money that it takes to continue running their campaign. So if we've seen the next round of polling after this debate and we see that the also-rans are still back in the
one,
pack.
1-2 points.
If they haven't really closed the gap between themselves and the top three, then I think there's going to be increasing pressure on some of them at least to drop out.
Let me ask each of you, Mo, did any one of those people who are polling at maybe 2% if they're lucky make a move that will impact the polling?
You know, that's hard. I really thought that Cory Booker was good last night, and that every time he had the opportunity to speak, he sort of gave a mini TED talk on the right things that America needs to do and the direction that we need to go in. So I would hate to see him drop out, even though he's polling at 1-2%, because I feel that he adds something to the conversation. Beto O'Rourke had a standout night, but obviously because they were in Texas. I mean, that wasn't hard to figure why, you know, he would stand out in that way. So
yeah, but his message about, I'm going to take your assault rifle, I'm going to come into your house, essentially, grab your guns. Yeah. It might have played well in the hall last night for among liberal Democrats, or Democrats, but oh my gosh.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, but if you think about the impact that he had just last night, I think he had a breakout for that moment because of where they were, a lot of factors.
I thought he did very well. You're right. I mean, that's going pretty far, and we didn't hear any other Democrats joining in and going that far. Some are saying they want voluntary buyback programs for these.
Let's listen to Beto O'Rourke when he talked about that.
In Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15, and that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Amy, he did very, all of the people who got a chance to mention this on the stage last night complimented Beto O'Rourke for how he handled things after particularly El Paso, but he didn't get much of a bump in the poll. I mean, I think he sincerely cared about his community, so there's a way in which I'm a little uncomfortable even framing it in such stark political terms. But it is a race for president, so you've got to.
It is, and some of the difficulty that starts to happen is it's not just about raising the money, but it's also that you need to start building a ground structure in each of these different states. And that's not only incredibly expensive, but you need people. And so, again, as we sort of get farther along, you're going to have a lot of those who would want to be on the ground saying, you know, I would like there to be fewer choices, right? This is getting too much. It's dividing it. It's spending too much money to be able to go between this. And that's really where the difficulty is. So you saw, I mean, certainly Andrew Yang tried to get attention. I'm not sure that it worked particularly well.
Yeah, we'll get to that a little later.
And I think it's also
he had some interesting lines.
You know, and his foreign policy answers also sort of suggested that he was a bit out of his depth. So that was, you know, so that sort of affects it there. On the other hand, I think Senator Harris had a really good answer this time comparatively to other ones about her criminal justice background and being attorney general. And the surprise there was perhaps Klobuchar's response, that she didn't seem as prepared to be able to answer that one.
Yeah.
And so,
which is one she should have been prepared for.
She should have
for.
Been. I mean, honestly, because that was not kind of a surprise that that was going to come. And so I think we're starting to see it. I mean, the problem is if you haven't moved at this point, and particularly if you haven't moved by the October debate, you're probably not going to move anymore.
Yeah. Galloway?
Just if we can go back to Beto O'Rourke.
Sure.
Number one, I don't think he's ever going to be president, at least not in the next 8 years or so.
Wow, that's a sweeping and bold statement.
I know it is.
And yes, he was still a young guy, though.
Yes, he had a home field advantage in Texas.
Yeah.
But I think also that he is seizing on a new issue for that's got political momentum for the first time, right. And he's something of a trailblazer on that issue.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
And even though he's, you know, some of the lines he's using aren't politic, I think he's grasping onto an emotion that people might resonate with him.
All right, I've teed up for you, Mr. Galloway, what I think was one of the really premier moments of the entire evening. It was an effort by Julian Castro to move up by attacking the front runner, Joe Biden. And I thought, we'll play it, and then you get first shot at this. Let's listen.
But the difference between what I support and what you support, Vice President Biden, is that you require them to opt in. And I would not require them to opt in. They would automatically be enrolled. They wouldn't have to buy in. That's a big difference, because Barack Obama's vision was not to leave 10 million people uncovered. He wanted every single person in this country covered. My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
All right. Ooh, ouch.
If you're going to, if you're going to attack somebody's memory, make sure you're right.
Yeah, he was wrong.
In this case, he wasn't. Although, I will tell, look, I agree with Mo. Joe Biden did perform very well, his best debate yet. But that last question on race was completely befuddling.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't have that, unfortunately.
But here's what's interesting about this, okay, is Biden is the one, is the candidate in there with the highest level of African-American support, I think 35% or so. I mean, the numbers are really, he unveiled something like, 200 state, African-American state lawmakers backing him up that in day. The hours before the debate. Yes. He's got Keisha Lance Bottoms campaigning for him in South Carolina next weekend. But it's the issue on which, when he's put on the spot on stage, that he can't talk
about.
Yeah,
but okay, but Alan, he's right, of course. But Alan, two things coming out of this. Number one, let me ask you to respond to the Julian Castro.
Yeah.
I mean, here's what the problem is with trying to make an impact in one debate to bring in some more donors and hope you can, you know, supercharge your campaign. Yeah. No one was as heavily criticized at the end of that debate as he was for the way he conducted himself.
And, you know, this is often the case with these debates, that even if the people actually watching the debate didn't catch that or didn't understand that was a mistake, at the time, there's been so much commentary about it since then.
Yes.
And that's been rerun over and over again. It's been run on the news. So now I think everyone who's watches the news at least understands that he, you know, botched that pretty badly.
It's the sort of thing, Mo, that could end your campaign, really.
I think it might be the thing that ends his campaign. And it certainly ends any thought that he could have a position as a VP pick or anything like that. And so it was just really unfortunate. I wondered if he thought the roar was a support roar, not a necessarily a oh my gosh roar. And that kept him going. Huh. Because I did go to the first debate that was in Miami, and it is a little hard inside of the debate hall to really understand if it's a heckler, a protester, or an at the first moment. So I'm imagining that if you're on the stage, it's even farther away
from
you.
That's exactly let me turn to the other thing, but what Jim said, I mean, he's right. I mean, at the end of the debate, Biden completely botched the question about race, but he's botched any number of comments he's made about race, and it hasn't had a single impact on his support among African Americans.
Yeah, I mean, you know, African American voters love Joe Biden, and it is the thing that the decency of Joe Biden is what keeps, I think, African American voters there. And so I think when the Julian Castro attack almost wiped away any things that happened that he didn't really answer. And so I think that that poor answer to the race question was kind of blown away by the, how dare he, you know, say that about his age or his memory.
And I do want to say, vis-a-vis your intro today, I do have a record player.
and right now,
there's a Billy Daniels record on it.
Kids, you
and
know, make
point,
sure
though,
you turn your record player
to
on
that
for
point,
your kids.
To the point of the support of African-American voters, that record player mention was actually something that sparks joyous memories in the African-American
community.
Oh, that's
wonderful. You're thinking
community.
About Motown.
I'm thinking about the parent. I literally, 1 year ago, bought my mother a record player, you know, the new revamped record players, because vinyl is coming back in.
Right. Oh, yeah. Amy, I'm sorry. We got to get to a break, but we got to do one last soundbite before we do, because you talk about the inherent decency that seems to continually trump for him, for Biden, all of these silly and sometimes really egregious mistakes he makes. Yeah. This is what he said at the close of the debate last night.
When you get hit badly, whether you're losing a job or you're raising a family like my dad, where you have to make that longest walk up the stairs to tell your kid you can't live here anymore. Dad lost his job. You know, we've all been through that, some form or another. And it just takes, it just, for me, the way I've dealt with it is finding purpose. And my purpose is do what I've always tried to do and stay engaged in public policy. And But there's a lot of people that through a lot worse than I have, get up every single morning, put their feet, one foot in front of another without the help I had. They're real heroes out there.
Thank you, Mr. Heroes.
So unfortunately, we didn't get the front end of that, which was the really powerful one. What are the challenges that you've had to overcome is the question. Right. He talked about the fact that his first wife and two of his children were killed in an automobile wreck, that he was just elected to the U.S. Senate from Delaware at the time, hadn't even been sworn in. He still had kids at home who were recovering. He would get on the train and go to Washington to the Senate and come home every night. And then, of course, he talked about the loss of Bo. So that was really the powerful part of what he said at the close. And that humanity comes through every time. I was on the train when he announced in 1987 for the White House. We got an opening speech in Wilmington from him. And then we all boarded, all of the press, the train to go to Washington to symbolically show what he'd been doing. That's one of the reasons that it's hard. You know, people love him despite all the mistakes.
Exactly. I mean, he's particularly good at that. And especially if we talk sort of as a contrast of who we know will be the opponent in November, is that we have he has empathy, which is something that Donald Trump has really struggled with.
He's got one other thing.
Decency.
He's got one other thing going for him that I think helps to explain that support that he's getting from African American voters in particular. And of course, that's having been Obama's vice president.
Yeah, sure. That doesn't hurt,
so
does it, Jim?
He can constantly talk about Barack this, Barack that, what Barack. And, you know, and last night, another thing that was interesting was that, in contrast to the earlier debates, all the candidates were praising Obama. And I think this was an kind of an attempt to correct for what they had done before.
Yeah.
Because Obama is very popular with Democratic voters.
Absolutely.
And that serves Biden very well, but especially with African-American voters.
I got to get to a break. You got one last quick comment before leading into the break?
To Alan's point, I think that's one of the reasons they went back and started talking up Obama is because they realized there's no wedge that can drive Obama and Biden apart.
That's right. And to your point, I think Julian Castro made a mistake by not talking about his involvement with the Obama administration and using it as a tool in the same way that Biden did. And I thought that was really a mistake. He could have had an alliance in that. Really, President Obama came out as one of the winners of the debate last night.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the other part of it is that a lot of people, right, the polls keep continually showing that Democratic primary voters emphasize electability over whether or not they actually agree on all the issues with the candidate that they support. And I think, again, that goes towards Biden.
All right. This is an all-star panel. I mean, I don't even want to take a break, but we've already gone about like 40 minutes, so we'd better get it done right now. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Time is running out for your chance to win a St. Simon's Island getaway for two and give our fall fun drive a head start. Go to gpb.org and click donate, and you'll also enter to win this vacation with a 3-night oceanfront stay at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. Relax on the beach, play golf, and enjoy meals in the resort's oceanfront dining room. That's gpb.org. Thanks for your support, and good luck.
Microsoft's president used to warn that regulation killed innovation. Now he wants the government to put some guardrails on tech.
To protect, frankly, something that is far more important than technology, democracy. It was here before us. It needs to be here and healthy after us.
That story, plus analysis of the Democratic presidential debate this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and on the GPB apps.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Jim Galloway is with me, Emory University political science professor Alan Abramowitz, Georgia State University political science professor Amy Steigerwald, and Mo Ivory, who is what we didn't say in introducing you, in addition to your work with Fair Fight Action, in addition to a lot of the other things you do, is that you were a candidate for Atlanta City Council a couple of years back.
I was, and what an experience that was.
Yeah, I'll bet.
I'll just leave that right there.
And people who are devoted to V103, and boy, there are a lot of them in this town, remember you well from your time working over there. It's really a pleasure to have you on for the first time.
Thank you so much.
Let's, if we can, let's do one last thing. You know, let's leave the debate and move on to other issues. But we can't go without playing Andrew Yang's idea. Andrew Yang, for the entire week before the debate, kept talking about the big surprise announcement he was going to have. Here it is.
That's why I'm going to do something unprecedented tonight. My campaign will now give a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for an entire year to 10 American families, someone watching this at home right now.
The really rich moment in that, Jim, was the next person to speak was Buttigieg. And the single shot of Buttigieg, he stood silently absorbing that for about 20 seconds.
And then he said, well, that's the original. That's right.
I think what he's done that with a couple of families out of his own pocket. But now he's talking about doing it using campaign funds. First, he's going to have a pilot program. You can go to his website, he says, and sign up and maybe get picked to be one of, I think, 10 families. I think he's going to run into real problems with the FEC over
there. I guess he could say that he's hiring these individual political consultants on a monthly basis.
Right.
Mo, this is just, again, here's an effort to break out somehow.
Yeah. You get a car.
Exactly.
I thought to myself,
he had another bizarre moment, too, I thought, where he made the comment that I'm Asian, so I know a lot of doctors.
Was that supposed to be a joke? Do you imagine that?
I guess he's gone there before.
Yeah, I think it was supposed to be humorous, but I'm Jewish, and I know a lot of comedians, and that wasn't funny.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. It wasn't funny at all. All right. So the next debate's in October. We'll stay on top of it. And, of course, we'll be following the presidential campaign, especially as it relates to Georgia as we move forward. Jim, let's move on to another big event that took place this past week. Well, I don't know if it was a big event. It was something. The House Judiciary Committee, led by Gerald Nadler, met to vote on whether to begin a process that sort of starts looking at an impeachment investigation or maybe just an inquiry. It was based on the fact that the House Democrats can't figure out what the heck, can't have any unanimity on what they want to do about an impeachment of Trump.
And what to call it. And you had you had three Georgians on that committee. You have Doug Collins, the ranking Republican. Then you have Hank Johnson, and you have Lucy McBath.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And of those three, Lucy McBath is the one who's really kind of on the spot in terms of a re-election bid in the 6th district. Yep. And she's thinking about a U.S. Senate run.
Yep. It's interesting. Again, I'm making light of it, but only because we don't really quite know. We do know they put a process in place where they can now talk to people privately. Mm-hmm. I think there are a number of things that they can now implement if they want to move toward an impeachment investigation.
And some of those are actually pretty important.
Yes.
I mean, so they also changed the rules that now they can have committee members be able to question people and not just the members of it, which is sort of a big move to sort of suggest that it's going into much more of an in-depth committee rather than just kind of being show hearings and investigations. The other part was the separating out of the powers to the subcommittees. That was actually one of the big fights that Representative Collins in particular really objected to, because again it means that now less people are able to kind of follow certain paths. It divides up the work and again makes it sort of easier if what they're trying to do is compile information to get towards an end.
So let's talk about the Georgians on the panel. Collins continues to be, as ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, Alan, the biggest defender that Trump has really right now on Capitol Hill. And you've got to say, watching him in action, he's done a great job on behalf of the president. He's very forceful in the way that he defends the president. It may be one of the reasons that he's could be one of the top choices for the seat, Johnny Isaacson's seat in the Senate.
Yeah, I think that he has positioned himself very well in that regard if he chooses to run for that seat. Because before this, probably very few people outside of his district knew who he was.
Yeah.
Now, he's still not a household name, but I mean, he's certainly more recognized, and I think this will be viewed very favorably by Republican voters in the state. So I think it's a smart move for him.
He's headed to Iowa next month.
Yeah, to speak for the Faith and Ralph Reed's group. He's doing a keynote speech for the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Mo, Hank Johnson and Lucy McBath both voted for resolution that moves the whatever it is process further along the way. But McBath was very insistent in the aftermath of her vote in saying, no, I haven't changed my position. I still believe there has to be a lot more evidence, a lot more information before I would actually vote to impeach the president of the United States. Of course, that hasn't stopped Georgia Republicans from saying she voted for impeachment yesterday or this week.
It's so hard. And I actually ran into her yesterday in Washington. I know she struggles with it because she's in the 6th. She has a re-election to come upon. But it's this very thing in the Democratic Party that bothers so many Democrats, because there's never a, well, maybe we should do it this way or that way in the Republican Party. It's absolutely not. And they all get on board with it. We have this thing in the Democratic Party where there's got to be a whole bunch of discussion and folks are worried about not leaning too far this way or that way. And really, When you talk to people privately, do they want President Trump impeached? Yes. Mm-hmm. And so for the support of that, it's mind-boggling that there's no definition around this, and there's all this scrambling for, well, it's not quite this yet, but it's this quite yet. I understand Lucy's problem. I understand why she's concerned
well,
about
also,
it. The attack came immediate.
Pelosi won't go there.
That's right.
So
her
if Pelosi
leader
won't go there, and you're a Lucy McBath, you need a little cover.
Well, Pelosi is doing that on behalf of people like Lucy McBath.
Exactly. That's my point. That's actually my point. But also, Jim made a really good other point about this. McBath may be deciding right now whether she, in fact, is going to run for the U.S. Senate rather and drop out of the campaign for the 6th District. Exactly. And that puts her, again, in a sort of a precarious position in terms of
It actually puts her in a safer position because she can say,
really?
I will be a member of the jury as a member of the Senate, so I just really need to stand back.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, thank you.
I would agree with that.
Thank you. Okay.
Right, because, the House gets tasked with, if they want to put forward articles of impeachment, right, they're the ones who say, here are the charges, but then the senators act as the jury and then do sort of that vote. And so it is that the initial step is sort of more of a political partisan one. I mean, not that the impeachment vote itself is not, but it does change it. And I think that you're right on that. And I think the other side of it is that there has been a lot of confusion about sort of what is going on, what are the things that people are even looking at, what are the standards, where have we put it that I think we're going to have to grapple with for a really long time. Yeah. I mean, it almost seems quaint to think back about the scandals we've had.
You know, I don't think there are going to be 218 votes in favor of any article of impeachment in the foreseeable future. I don't see that happening, and time's running out. It's the reality.
Keep an eye on John Lewis.
Well, that's what. Let's do this. I'm just really interested in what the panel has to say, so I'm sort of neglecting our breaks, but I better get to our final one. We'll come back. Let's talk about what Jim Galloway just mentioned on Political Rewind. Yeah, let's.
GPB's fall fund drive starts soon, but the time to give is now. Your contribution at gpb.org before the drive starts will do twice the good. You'll support the programs you enjoy, and your gift will be part of our challenge fund to inspire others to join you in supporting GPB during the fund drive. You'll also have a chance to win a St. Simons Island getaway to the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. So please go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks.
What do Renaissance paintings, the gardens of Versailles, and Washington, D.C. all have in common? They've all been designed with geometry in mind. I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, how this ancient field of mathematics, invented by the Greeks, shaped our modern world. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Join us for Science Friday this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
Same way she had been behind gun legislation.
Yeah. I think we're back.
Oh, we started already.
You know what? We should just keep the cameras rolling. We should put this show in a little box in the corner because this is such a great panel to keep going.
Bill, right. Let me just say this one thing real quick about Lucy McBath. The people in the 6th loved Lucy for everything she stood for. You know, when her son was murdered, she stood up for gun rights. She joined this coalition of mothers, and they voted for her because of her passion for that. So I don't think if she would have joined in passionately about impeaching the president, that those same voters would have said, oh, well, now I can't vote for Lucy. They're in for Lucy. And I think that you can't start changing yourself when you start getting into this political game. And I just fear that that could happen, and I don't want it
to. And the other side of that is that I don't think she's going to win over many Trump supporters in her district and Republican voters by, opposing this appearing to be very reluctant to support the move toward impeachment. So, I don't think that she's helping herself there.
Okay. Jim, John Lewis made a comment that's probably more dramatic than many of the other things being said about impeachment. He said, what's the exact... I'm moving to the air. What was
my,
it?
My time is almost
My time is near.
My time is almost near.
If John Lewis comes out and says we need to impeach President Trump, what's its impact on the House?
Well, number one, you've got intense pressure from four other Democrats from Georgia, McBath, Johnson, David Scott, and Sanford Bishop, he would lead the way of the Congressional Black Caucus, and that would probably that would put Nancy Pelosi in a position. But you know, so in a way, John Lewis is also kind of the bulwark against against impeachment at this point.
Yeah,
he's kind of this moral voice that's going to say so over this. I find that very intriguing.
Did you? Who talked to?
This was an interview that he did with Politico yesterday.
Okay, so I guess the reason I'm asking that is, I mean, that comment could mean one of two. That could mean I'm moving to the point where I think it's too late, and I want to ask Ellen what that means, too late. Mm-hmm. Or it could mean I think we're going to have no choice. We don't really know, do we?
No. Okay. I mean, he's walking a very fine line.
Right. Ellen, why is it getting
I mean,
first
too
of all, late?
I think the problem they're facing is that they need testimony from some of the people around Trump to really seal the deal and convince enough Democrats to get to 218 votes on an article of impeachment, and I don't think there's time to do that. I don't think they're going to be able to compel those people to testify in time for that to happen. And then if we get much later and into 2020, it's an election year.
Yeah.
And again, I think it just makes it even more difficult. So I think the reality is that this is never going to happen. I just don't think that they're going to vote on articles of impeachment, because I think the priority has to be on what do we need to do to make sure Trump is a one-term president, not to try to kick him out of office, which is not going to happen anyway, because obviously the Senate would never vote to convict him, to get rid of him a few months before his term would end anyway.
So, Mo, and then Amy, I'd like to get you on this, too. You talked a little while ago in another context about marketing, branding, whatever. I've heard any number of analysts say something I think is fascinating. You can come up with articles 2, 3, 4, and 5 for why Trump ought to be impeached, but you need the marquee issue. What's article number 1? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Wow.
I'm not asking you to tell us what
it
is.
Okay, because I was thinking I'm trying to come up with this fast.
No, in fact, the point of that statement has been there isn't yet one that they've been able to identify. Sure. I don't know how true that seems, but I'm interested in yours and Amy's thoughts.
You know, I had never heard it put that way, exactly that way before, and coupled with what you're saying about the timing, you know, that could really be it. And inserting John Lewis into this, like you said, the moral voice of America, could be... it could be either they can't find that number one or they're really close to that number one. And so I don't know the answer
to that. So, Amy, part of that is you could look at the Mueller report and see the 10-plus incidents that he defined that show obstruction by the president.
Yeah.
But that's 10 different items. Mm-hmm. How do you roll that together and make it, a marquee issue? I think that's part of what the question here is.
Well, I think it's also a question, so it's sort of going into the timing that Ellen was mentioning, the fact that as soon as the Mueller report came out, if they had immediately said, the marquee thing is obstruction of justice, here's 10 clear instances that have been outlined from Mueller, and Mueller said that this is something that has to be handled in the political process and that is left to Congress, then it would be sort of easy to move forward. And what's interesting is that by delaying, they also almost took that off the table as being what they could point to because it should have been able that they could have the next day.
But I think part of that, Jim, is also, and then I know you want to answer this your own way, but part of that also is Trump has done such an effective job of negating, for his people at least, everything critical that's said about him, including the obstruction.
And the refusal to cooperate with Congress on anything can be another ground. But again, another ground for impeachment. But again, it's number 3, 4, or 5.
Right.
I've said this on air before, and I'll say it again. We have to remember that Richard Nixon was impeached only in his second term, not in his first.
Yeah, Alan?
And you know, there were the tapes, and you know, so I think the obstruction would have to be the first if they're going to vote articles of impeachment. The other big one, I would say, the second biggest one to me, is the has to do with the emoluments clause,
and it's the corruption. Except Trump has fought those off. I mean,
he's But I think that's where, I mean, and again, in both of those regards, especially obstruction, the problem is that you really would need or would like to have at least testimony from people close to Trump who right. could back that up. Said, yes, you know, he directed me to stop this investigation and so on. Or, yes, you know, we're trying to get people to stay at his property so that, you know, his business would benefit.
Right. One other quick item before we completely run out of time. Jim, Karen Handel, I read this in the Political Insider blog, seems to have ruled herself out as someone who would like Nathan Deal, Brian Kemp, to appoint her to that vacant Johnny Isaacson seat.
Right,
why?
Right.
Why would she do that?
Well, I think she understands that she's probably not in that particular circle. She's run two statewide races before and lost both of them. The only one the latest one that she's won, other than Secretary of State, pretty long ago, is the 6th district. And if Lucy McBath should decide to run for Senate, well, then she becomes an immediate favorite, I think.
Yeah. All right. Listen, we're completely out of time for today's show. Amy Steiger, Walt, it's been a pleasure to have you back. Mo Ivor, will you come back? It's been fun to have
Absolutely.
You on.
Absolutely.
Good,
Thank
good,
you.
Good. Alan Abramowitz, we always love it when you come in. And Jim Galloway, you're going to be back with me on Monday at 2 o'clock, starting a whole new week of Political Rewind. I look forward to that.
Me too.
All right, everybody. That's just about it for us here at Political Rewind. By the way, real quick, big Sunday night for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Ken Burns' 8-part, 16-hour series on country music starts on the Sunday night. And I got to tell you, if you love country music like I do, it's going to blow you away. Try to tune in and see it. And be back with us for Political Rewind tomorrow at 2.